From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! Hamas is in full control of the Gaza Strip, following days of bloody clashes with rival Palestinian faction Fatah. Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas has dismissed the Hamas-led government and declared a state of emergency. The occupied territories have now been effectively split into two separate entities, with Hamas in charge of Gaza and Fatah controlling the West Bank. We'll get the latest. Then, opposition is growing against President Bush's nominee to be the next Surgeon General. Leading gay rights groups are calling on senators to reject the confirmation of Dr. James Holsinger. He has argued homosexuality is unnatural and dangerous, and that sexual orientation is a lifestyle choice. So all that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Hamas is in full control of the Gaza Strip following days of bloody clashes with rival Palestinian faction Fatah. Hamas militants have seized the presidential compound in Gaza City following a week of fighting that's left more than 100 people dead. Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas has dismissed the Hamas-led government, declared a state of emergency. This is senior Abbas advisor Tayyab Abdelrahim.
We are declaring a state of emergency in all the Palestinian territories because of the criminal war in the Gaza Strip, the occupation of the Palestinian Authority security headquarters, and the military coup of the armed militias that are working outside the law of the Palestinian legislation.
Abbas says he will rule by presidential decree until conditions allow for early elections. But Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh of Hamas said his government will carry on.
This evening, Mr. President Abu Mazen took hasty decisions. And some of the people surrounding the president did not read the consequences on the public Palestinian arena. The existing government will carry out its duties and tasks in the best way possible and will not give up on its national and ethical responsibilities towards the Palestinian people.
The occupied territories are effectively split into two separate entities, with Hamas in charge of Gaza and Fatah controlling the West Bank. The Bush administration appears to have settled on the outcome. There are reports today the White House will boost aid to Abbas while allowing Gaza to slip into further despair in order to weaken Hamas's popular standing. On Thursday, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice gave her backing to Abbas.
President Abbas has exercised his lawful authority as president of the Palestinian Authority, as the leader of the Palestinian people. I will remind that he was elected in 2005 by large margin, and we fully support him in his decision to try and end this crisis for the Palestinian people and to give them an opportunity for to return to peace and a better future.
More on the Palestinian crisis after headlines. In Iraq, at least 13 Sunni mosques have come under fire since Wednesday's attack on the Askariya Shrine in Samarra. Despite the attacks, Iraq has avoided a surge in violence that followed the first bombing of the Shia shrine last year. 33 bodies were found in Baghdad Thursday, a relative low for the past several months. Insurgents fired a barrage of rockets into the Baghdad Green Zone, hitting a street Deputy Secretary of State John Negroponte had visited just minutes before. Meanwhile, the U.S. military has announced 5 U.S. troops have been killed over the last day. In other Iraq news, another Iraqi journalist has been killed. Voices of Iraq correspondent Araf Ali died Monday while on assignment in Diyala province. Ali is the third Voices of Iraq correspondent slain in 2 weeks. Vice President Dick Cheney's former chief of staff, Louis Scooter Libby, could be behind bars within 2 months. On Thursday, a federal judge denied Libby's attempt to delay the start of a sentence. Libby was convicted in March on 4 felony counts of making false statements to the FBI, lying to a grand jury, and obstructing a probe into the leak of Valerie Plame's identity. Administration officials outed Plame after her husband, former U.S. Ambassador Joe Wilson, publicly challenged the Bush administration's case for going to war with Iraq. Meanwhile, Judge Reggie Walton said he'd received several threatening letters after handing down Libby's 2.5-year sentence. Walton also criticized a brief from 12 law professors, including Harvard's Alan Dershowitz, that argued Libby should avoid jail time. Walton said, quote, "The submission was not something I would expect from a first-year law student." Libby could still avoid prison if President Bush grants him a pardon. In Mississippi, a former member of the Ku Klux Klan has been found guilty of kidnapping and conspiracy in connection with the murder of two black teenagers in 1964. James Ford Seal was first arrested shortly after the killings, but the charges were thrown out after the FBI turned the case over to local authorities. The Justice Department reopened the case 2 years ago. During the trial, Seal's cousin, Charles Marcus Edwards, testified he and Seal had abducted and attacked the black teenagers. Edwards said Seal and other Klansmen then drove the teenagers across the Louisiana border. They put duct tape over their mouths and dumped them in the Mississippi River alive. The victims, Henry Hezekiah Dee and Charles Eddie Moore, were both 19 years old. Their bodies were found about 2 months later when authorities were conducting an intensive search for the slain civil rights workers Andrew Goodman, James Chaney, and Michael Schwerner. Seal could face life in prison. In Lebanon, thousands of people observed a national day of mourning for the killing of 10 people, including the lawmaker Walid Aido. Aido was the sixth leading anti-Syrian campaigner slain in the last 2 years. Syria denies involvement in the attack. Meanwhile, UN envoy Michael Williams emerged from a meeting with Syria's vice president, who condemned the bombing.
I did discuss with the vice president the situation in Lebanon, and I was very pleased to know that the Syrian government issued a very strong condemnation of the tragic assassination which took place in Beirut.
The U.S. has rejected a Russian offer to host a jointly run missile shield in Azerbaijan as an alternative to sites in Eastern Europe. Speaking at a NATO meeting in Belgium, Defense Secretary Robert Gates said the U.S. will continue with plans in Poland and the Czech Republic.
It was very explicit in the meeting that we saw the Azeri radar as an additional capability, that we intended to proceed with the radar, the X-band radar, the Czech Republic.
In Mexico, thousands of people marched through Oaxaca City Thursday to mark the first anniversary of a bloody crackdown on striking school teachers that sparked last year's popular uprising. At least 15 people were killed in the months of protests against State Governor Ulysses Ruiz. This is Teachers Union spokesperson Daniel Rosas Romero.
We can still remember the arrest warrants, the investigations prior to the arrests. We are demanding the cancellation of these arrests and the total freedom of political prisoners who were arrested during that time, on May 22, 2006, when the camps were set up.
Meanwhile, a reporter for the Mexican newspaper Tiempo is in stable condition after being shot by unknown assailants. Misael Sanchez Sarmiento had received death threats over his investigative reporting and the shooting death of the U.S. journalist Brad Will. Will was killed while covering the Oaxaca uprising last October. On Capitol Hill, Senate leaders have reached an agreement that puts the immigration bill back on the table. Lawmakers have agreed to consider 11 new amendments from Democrats and Republicans. In other news from Washington, D.C., the Justice Department has announced it'll expand its internal probe into the firing of 9 U.S. attorneys to look at whether Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez tried to influence the testimony of his former senior aide, Monica Goodling. Goodling has told lawmakers Gonzalez made her uncomfortable when he tried to compare notes on how the firings occurred. In environmental news, the National Climatic Data Center has announced global temperatures this year have tied with the warmest period on record, set in 1998. A former prisoner swept up in the post-9/11 crackdown on Arab and Muslim males in the United States has won a motion to continue a lawsuit accusing several government officials of ethnic and religious discrimination. Javed Iqbal said he suffered physical and verbal abuse while spending more than 150 days in solitary confinement without a hearing. Former Attorney General John Ashcroft and FBI Director Robert Mueller are among those accused in the case. An internal probe has concluded the FBI may have committed more than 1,000 breaches of the law or agency rules while gathering data on phone calls, emails, and financial transactions in the United States. The probe covers just 10% of FBI investigations, meaning the actual number of violations could top 10,000. Most of the breaches came in cases where agents retained phone and email records mistakenly provided by service providers. Here in New York, a federal judge has reversed his own order that had put strict limits on police spying on protests and events. In February, Judge Charles Haight ruled police must stop the routine videotaping of people at public gatherings unless there's an indication that unlawful activity may occur. Judge Haight had cited two events that the police videotaped, a march in Harlem and a demonstration by homeless people in front of the Upper East Side home of Mayor Michael Bloomberg. But this week, Haight said he was vacating the order after city lawyers told him new information on the gatherings. Lawyers for the plaintiffs say they'll challenge the reversal. And finally, in Washington state, a judge has dismissed charges against 16 people who took part in an anti-war protest at the port of Tacoma last year. The accused were arrested as they tried to block the military from shipping Stryker armored vehicles to Iraq. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Hamas is in full control of the Gaza Strip following days of bloody clashes with the rival Palestinian faction Fatah. Hamas militants seized the presidential compound in Gaza City overnight after a week of fighting, which has left more than 100 people dead. Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas Thursday announced the dismissal of the Hamas-led government and declared a state of emergency. Abbas said he would now rule by presidential decree until the conditions are right for early elections. However, Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh says his government will press on and impose law and order. The occupied territories have now been effectively split into two separate entities, with Hamas in charge of Gaza and Fatah controlling the West Bank. Chief Palestinian negotiator Saab Erekat told Agence France-Presse, quote, "This is the worst thing I've seen since 1967. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice gave her backing to Mahmoud Abbas, saying he had exercised his, quote, lawful authority. There are reports today the Bush administration will boost aid to Abbas while allowing Gaza to slip into further despair in order to weaken Hamas's popular standing. Meanwhile, Haaretz reports Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert is planning to tell President Bush that there is an urgent need to view the West Bank and the Gaza Strip as separate entities and prevent contact between them. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon held preliminary talks on the idea of sending an international force to Gaza, but Hamas rejected the move, saying it would treat foreign troops as occupation forces. There are new fears. Violence will now spread to the West Bank, where Fatah militants have rounded up nearly 90 Hamas fighters and claimed to have killed a Hamas member in retaliation for events in Gaza. This all comes as new details emerge about criticism from a former top U.N. envoy on the U.S. and U.N. role in Israel in the occupied territories. In a confidential report disclosed earlier this week, Alvaro de Soto condemns the boycott on the Palestinian government and says the U.S. and Israel virtually neutralized prospects for peace. Leila Al-Haddad is a Palestinian journalist. She writes for AlJazeera.net and is making a film on Gaza's underground economy. She maintains a blog called Raising Yusuf, a diary of a mother under occupation. Leila lives in Gaza and the United States. She returned from Gaza last week, joins us in our Firehouse studio. Ali Abu Nima is co-founder of the online publication Electronic Intifada. He's the author of the book One Country, a bold proposal to end the Israeli-Palestinian impasse. He joins us from Chicago. And on the line from Gaza is Faris Akram, a freelance journalist in Gaza City. We will go to you, Faris, first. Tell us what is happening today on the ground in Gaza.
Now Hamas supporters and partisans, thousands of them, are taking to the streets in all over Gaza Strip to celebrate what they call the victory, the day of victory on which Gaza was cleaned from the corruption and the corruption makers. Those rallies have witnessed the some violence as a rally in the central Gaza Strip came under fire and one person from Hamas was killed. These rallies came after all the security compounds that are loyal to President Mahmoud Abbas of rival Fatah have fallen in Hamas' grip after days of bloody fighting that left more than 130 Palestinians dead.
And what is the feeling of the general population right now about what is happening, about Hamas being in charge of Gaza now, in control, and Fatah of the West Bank?
During the fighting, some of Hamas leaders have voted that they will clean Gaza from secularism. And this has created fears among the ordinary people that their personal freedom might be confiscated and that Hamas may be going to impose their radical thoughts on the society. But soon after the capturing of the security compound, Hamas has assured the people that the fighting was aimed at the coup seekers among the security chiefs and those Fatah leaders who implement U.S. Orders on the Gaza Strip. And their war was against those who tried to confiscate Hamas' victory that the Islamic movement has achieved in January 2006 parliamentary elections. Now Hamas men are calling on the security members to surrender and lay down their personal guns. And give them an ultimatum that ends after half an hour. But they said anyone who delivers his weapon before the deadline, he would enjoy full amnesty. And also, Hamas has given amnesty to Fatah people, including some major security chiefs who were captured yesterday and released them today. Also, Hamas leaders are assuring the people that they will spread the Islam in a very civilized way and will not be like a Taliban. And they have been promising the people that Gaza is very safe now. Any individual can walk from Beit Hanun in the north of Gaza Strip to Rafah city in far south of Gaza Strip. We're enjoying full safety without being ambushed or killed or his car stolen. And so Hamas has been promising the safety and security. And the few coming days will show if Hamas promises can come true or not.
And the reports that Hamas had executed some Fatah fighters yesterday?
At least they have executed two Fatah leaders. A day after the execution, the chief Hamas Mufti has issued the fatwa approving the killing of Samih al-Madhoun, who Hamas accuses of being a symbol of those who try to confiscate Hamas legitimacy. Samih al-Madhoun used to live in northern Gaza Strip, and he was responsible for abducting tens of Hamas men and torturing them, and also killing a number of Hamas partisans. 2 months ago, Hamas reached a deal with Fatah to evacuate al-Madhoun from northern Gaza Strip and position him in Abbas security compound. And the deal came into effect. But when the previous round of violence erupted last month, al-Madhoun was responsible for abducting and killing a number of Hamas men, including three pro-Hamas journalists. So Hamas has taken a decision to kill to kill al-Madhoun, and their Mufti has approved this decision. But on the other hand, this was the only two events of execution, public execution.
Faris Akraman, thank you for being with us, joining us from Gaza City, a freelance journalist. When we come back from break, Leila Al-Dad and Ali Abu Nima will be with us to talk further about the mass crisis in Gaza and the West Bank. Stay with us. The music here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue on Gaza and the West Bank, our guest, Leila Al-Haddad, Palestinian journalist, mother living in Gaza, just came to the United States last week, and Ali Abu Nima joining us in Chicago, co-founder of the online publication Electronic Intifada. Describe what it is like to live in Gaza right now and what you understand to be happening. Leila?
Well, you know, as you mentioned, I was just there, just came back last Friday. And the day I was trying to leave, it took me several days to leave because the Rafah crossing, of course, which is still controlled by Israel, and the only outlet for Gazans to the outside world, is open less than a quarter of the time and is extremely difficult for people to pass. As I was leaving, we were hearing reports of activity and things happening in Rafah, in the southern Gaza Strip, the beginning of this latest bout of fighting. And of course, when I was there a month ago, or a few weeks ago rather, the most recent spate of fighting had begun, and then it was sort of quelled and died down. And for a few days, it was extremely terrifying in our apartment in Gaza, central Gaza City. We were penned in there for about 4 days. We couldn't leave. It was very unpredictable. The situation was very volatile. There were snipers that had taken position on various high-rise towers throughout the city, and masked gunmen throughout the streets. And what we had seen was a new phenomenon that we had not seen before, was these stopping of cars and random abductions and targeting of journalists very specifically, so journalists were not going out on the streets. And again, it was by masked gunmen. Nobody knew who was who and who was doing what, and so it was best just to stay indoors until that had passed. And so it sounds very similar to what has happened. Maybe this was in greater intensity in the past few days.
Ali Abu Nima, can you describe who is arming both sides, Fatah and Hamas?
Yes. What we've seen is really a direct result of the Bush doctrine. Since January 2006, when Hamas won the legislative election fair and square, the United States refused the election result, and it has been arming several Palestinian militias, particularly those controlled by the Gaza warlord Mohammed Dahlan. This is a repeat strategy of the Contras. These are Palestinian Contras. And the architect of this policy is none other than Elliot Abrams, the deputy national security advisor, who was convicted for lying to Congress in the Iran-Contra scandal. And the Alvaro de Soto, the UN report that you mentioned in the introduction, Amy, confirms in detail the extent of the conspiracy that the United States has been undertaking to overthrow the election result and destroy Hamas. And just a few days before this round of fighting started, on June 7th, Haaretz, the Israeli newspaper, reported that senior Fatah commanders in the Gaza Strip had asked Israel for millions of rounds of ammunition, RPGs, hand grenades, and armored cars to use against Hamas. So I think what we've seen is Hamas taking a last resort move to put an end to what it describes as a coup intended to overthrow the election result. It's a major blow for the United States and for the Bush doctrine, although it's very hard to see how it helps Palestinians very much, considering that Israel and the United States are likely to tighten the siege of Gaza and to continue to fund the militias. We've already seen Condoleezza Rice throwing her support behind Abbas, and no sign of a let-up in U.S. interference and armed intervention in Palestinian affairs.
How do the weapons get to both sides? And does that aid that Condoleezza Rice is talking about include weapons?
Yes. The weapons that have been delivered to the Fatah militias, to the Palestinian Contras of Mohammed Dahlan, come via Egypt and are delivered with the direct coordination of Israel. The Fatah commanders make requests to Israel, and Israel coordinates the delivery of the weapons to Egypt. Hamas gets its weapons. There are reports that Hamas receives funding from Iran. Hamas also gets its weapons from Egypt. What's notable is that many of the weapons that Israel delivers to Fatah for use against Hamas are then sold on by corrupt Fatah commanders to the highest bidder. So recently, Israel has been actually turning down Fatah requests for weapons because they say to the Fatah commanders, you just turn around and sell the weapons to Hamas. So Gaza is absolutely awash with weapons, and nobody seems to have any difficulty getting hold of them.
Ali Abunima, you've written the book One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestinian Impasse. Now there's discussion of three countries, not even a two-state solution: Gaza, West Bank, Israel. Your response?
I wouldn't put too much stock in that, because the Israeli policy of cutting Gaza off from the West Bank is long-standing. It's been there for more than a decade, that Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank can't travel from one place to the other. What I think we are seeing is the collapse of the two-state solution. Alvaro de Soto acknowledged that in his leaked confidential report. And today in the Washington Post, Edward Abington, the former U.S. Consul General in Jerusalem and now a lobbyist for the Palestinian Authority, was quoted saying that these events signal the death of the two-state solution. I think we have to recognize that the Israeli policy of trying to create Palestinian ghettos and bantustans is failing before our very eyes. Palestinians are the majority population in Israeli-ruled territory between Jordan and the Mediterranean Sea, and it's only a matter of time before the world wakes up to this reality.
Leila Al-Haddad, what does this separation mean? And would you say it's been effectively a separation between West Bank and Gaza for a long time, or life on the ground every day, as you write your blog, Raising Your Child in Gaza?
Yeah, I was just actually going to say, when you were commenting about, and not just too many people saying Gaza and the West Bank have been split now and two different authorities. I mean, it's always been the case for you know, over a decade now, that Israel has effectively separated Gaza from the West Bank, and in the recent 2 years hermetically sealed the Gaza Strip, as I mentioned, opening the Rafah crossing less than a quarter of the time for 1.5 million people, the only passage for 1.5 million people. So to me, I see this as part of the way that it's being described, and the separation as part of the sort of the larger plan. And what's taken place, of course, in Gaza, while terribly tragic to watch, you know, as a Palestinian, for me signals the failure of the Bush policy over the past 2 years of starving Gaza's population, of trying to fund and arm Hamas with something of $84 million. And, you know, I've seen these, the Badr brigades that they're trying to arm in Jordan and train in Jericho and Egypt. As I was leaving, they stalled the Rafah crossing as they allowed in several hundred and thousand of these troops last Thursday.
You interviewed one of the men who was recently executed, recently killed.
That's right. I interviewed Samih al-Madhoun, who was Mohammed Dahalan's sort of right-hand man in the northern Gaza Strip and the head of what's known as the Fatah death squads. I interviewed him in December for an article I was writing about the beginning of the infighting, and it was called An Eye for an Eye in Gaza. I interviewed members of the Hamas executive force and then Samih al-Madhoun. And I had asked him about the situation and where he thinks it will go, where it will lead to, and who he gets his orders from. And I specifically asked him if he gets them from Mohammed Dahalan. And he said, everybody gets their orders from somewhere. And I said, what do you anticipate will happen? And he said, well, it's going to get to a point where we're not going to hold back anymore, and we're going to take that extra step and just attack, and we're just waiting for the right time. And so this was in December, but I think he knew that his days were limited from his talk, at least.
You've also been writing about the underground economy. How does that work?
Right. My colleague and I, Saeed Farouki, were working on a film called Gaza's Underground Economy, which is about the tunnel trade in Gaza that evolved over the past decade and a half or so as a direct result of Gaza's economic and political isolation. This is the trade that takes place under the Egyptian Gaza border in southern Gaza Strip of Rafah. And it, while certainly there are, basic weaponry like Kalashnikovs, bullets that are traded, it also involves something much more complex and is a means of sustenance for a lot of families there. It involves everything from food processors to even car parts and often heart medicines, and even people who lack ID cards that can come into Gaza are often smuggled through these tunnels. Mm-hmm. And that trade has evolved over the past 3 years as Gaza's isolation has increased.
We're very much reporting on this as Hamas, Fatah, internal mm-hmm. fight, a civil war. Where does Israel fit into this?
Well, I mean, it plays a huge part. And every time this discussion comes up, I like to remind people that this is not something happening in isolation. It's not as though it just things erupted. Certainly the factors were there. The environment was ripe for this to happen. But this was the result of years and years of siege. And most recently, a U.S.-led global siege and an Israeli siege and aggressive, violent occupation of the Gaza Strip that has completely, as I mentioned, isolated it from the West Bank, from Palestinians, from their counterparts in Jerusalem, the West Bank, and the outside world, of course, in addition to the Israeli, continued American, rather, training and funding of Fatah, very, you know, something that is not unambiguous in any terms. And as Ali mentioned, just last week, they were asking and actually received training and funding in Jericho, and Israel allowed them passage to train in Jericho.
Ali Abu Nima, Alvaro de Soto, who you talked about, the just-retired UN coordinator for the Middle East, has warned international hostility to the Palestinian Hamas movement could have grave consequences by persuading millions of Muslims that democratic methods don't work. He said Hamas is in its effervescence and can potentially evolve in a pragmatic direction that would allow for a two-state solution, but only if handled right. Your response to this?
I think Alvaro de Soto's 53-page report is very revealing. It's on the internet in PDF form. It was leaked. It is a savage indictment of U.S., Israeli, and European Union policy. I think any objective observer would agree with Alvaro de Soto and would agree that from the moment it won the elections, Hamas had tried to be pragmatic and flexible. It had observed a unilateral truce with Israel. It had given up suicide attacks against Palestinian civilians. And there was no response to that. On the contrary, the United States, Israel, the European Union, and some Arab states decided to launch a war against Hamas. By trying to deny Hamas its fair share, and Hamas asked for less than its fair share, it is the one that immediately after the election offered a national unity government. By denying it its fair share, they have assured that Hamas has taken the whole pie. It's time for them to radically change their approach. Stop treating the Palestinians like puppets and toys who can be manipulated, and start treating them like human beings who deserve at last their full human rights and freedom, just like any other people.
You said Palestinian suicide attacks against Palestinian civilians. You mean Israeli civilians?
Of course, that's exactly what I meant. Hamas had effectively suspended that tactic and had observed a unilateral truce with Israel. Amy, in 2006, Israel killed 700 Palestinians, half of whom were civilians, and 141 of whom were children. In the same period, Palestinians killed 23 Israelis, and the world is demanding that Palestinians renounce violence. It's time to start treating the Palestinians fairly and end this dirty war that the United States and Israel are waging against the Palestinians, just as the United States and Elliot Abrams waged such a dirty war for so long against people in Central America. It's time for it to end.
How does this relate to these two other crises now? You've got Iraq, you've got what's happening in the occupied territories and its relation to Israel, and you've got Lebanon.
It relates directly, because the wider U.S. strategy now is to install or support puppet regimes and client militias throughout the region in Afghanistan, Iraq, Lebanon, and Palestine in order to fight proxy wars against the United States, against this phantom enemy of an Islamic caliphate that George Bush and his friends have dreamed up. And everywhere it's failing. In Afghanistan, the Taliban are resurgent. Iraq, as you report every day, the U.S. can't even trust the Iraqi militias and the Iraqi army that it's set up. And we see the total failure of the surge as violence intensifies. In Lebanon, the United States has been arming and funding the Lebanese army, hoping that it will be a counterweight to Hezbollah. And we've seen the Lebanese army performing very poorly against a few militants, foreign fighters in Nahr el-Bared refugee camp, although they've caused devastation to the refugee camp itself. So now we see the U.S.-backed Palestinian Contras being routed in Gaza. Also, final point, I wouldn't overestimate the strength of Fatah or underestimate the strength of Hamas in the West Bank, because Hamas has considerable resources in the West Bank. The thing I fear, though, is that the United States and its allies in the Palestinian Authority will be foolish enough to try to do in the West Bank what they've just failed to do in Gaza, and that would bring increased disaster and chaos for Palestinians throughout the West Bank as well.
Leila Al-Haddad, you write the blog Mother from Gaza.blogspot.com. How do you live every day? And talk about your son. How do people wake up in the morning? Where do you go? How do you take shelter?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a very complicated situation to explain to a three-year-old. And I mean in terms of actually entering Gaza, in terms of living in Gaza, in terms of explaining what is Gaza and who is in control of Gaza. As we go through the crossing, he says, who's not allowing us through when we're stuck in the crossing, and trying to explain to him who that is. And then he sees, of course, on one side Egyptians, and on the other he sees Palestinians, and then he sees European monitors, and yet it's an outside force, meaning the Israelis, who are ultimately closing the crossing. And then, of course, going into Gaza and being subject to periods of time, these bits of infighting, and him having to deal with the gunfire and so forth. And, children are extremely adaptable, but of course he has become terrified by the loud sound of the gunfire on one hand or the Israeli shelling on the other, and just has taken to closing his ears. So I just told him that there was a lot of popcorn being made outside, and when the gunfire subsided, he got excited and said, oh, I think the popcorn is done, can we go and see it? So, he managed that fairly well, at least for, those few days. But it's certainly a very, troubling, setting and environment to be raising a child in for any Palestinian, certainly, whether it's dealing with the occupation on one hand or the infighting on the other.
And the level of hunger, of malnutrition?
I mean, hunger, people like to focus, and certainly, you know, with cause, on the hunger and on the malnutrition, and that is a major concern, especially seeing as how it's been so methodical. But I like to point out that it's not just mere hunger that is the problem here. You know, you're starving a people of their basic freedoms and their rights, and I think ultimately that in the grand scheme, of course, becomes very significant and important.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. We'll certainly continue to follow this situation. Leila Haddad is a Palestinian journalist, a mother living in Gaza, writing Raising Yusuf, a diary of a mother under occupation. Ali Abu Nima, speaking to us from Chicago, co-founder of the online publication The Electronic Intifada. His book is called One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestinian Impasse, published by Metropolitan Books last year. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report, back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Washington, D.C., opposition is growing against President Bush's nominee to be the next Surgeon General. Leading gay rights groups are calling on senators to reject the confirmation of Dr. James Holsinger. Holsinger has argued that homosexuality is unnatural and dangerous, and that sexual orientation is a lifestyle choice. In 2000, he helped form the Hope Springs Community Church, which has a special program that it claims to cure gay men and lesbians. If confirmed as Surgeon General, Holsinger would become the country's chief health educator. Dr. Holsinger is a cardiologist who has served as Secretary of the Kentucky Cabinet for Health and Family Services and is Chancellor of the University of Kentucky Medical Center. He's also a former medical director at the Veterans Health Administration. Already two senators who will review his nomination, Barack Obama and Christopher Dodd, have expressed concern. In a statement, Senator Obama said, quote, "I have serious reservations about nominating someone who would inject his own anti-gay ideology into critical decisions about the health and well-being of our nation." Much of criticism centers on a paper Dr. Holsinger prepared in 1991 for the United Methodist Church's Committee to Study Homosexuality. The document, entitled Pathophysiology of Male Homosexuality, tries to make the medical argument that homosexuality is unnatural and unhealthy. In it, Holsinger writes, quote, "The logical complementarity of the human sexes has been so recognized in our culture that it has entered our vocabulary in the form of naming various pipe fittings, either the male fitting or the female fitting, depending on which one interlocks within the other. When the complementarity of the sexes is breached, injuries and diseases may occur," he wrote. The White House has declined to address criticism of Dr. Holsinger. Spokesperson Tony Snow was asked about Holsinger's views at a White House news conference Wednesday.
The Los Angeles Times and the Washington Post both report that Dr. James Holsinger, the president's nominee for Surgeon General has been denounced by homosexual activists as well as by presidential candidates Edwards and Clinton because in 1991 Dr. Holsinger wrote that sex between people of the same sex, especially men, could lead to many sexual serious health problems. And given the medical accuracy of the doctor's statement, what is the president's reaction to such attacks on this physician who is his nominee?
You know what? I haven't asked him about that, so I don't know.
Wait a minute. The national organization Parents and Friends of Ex-Gays and Gays has issued a statement that the denunciations of Dr. Holsinger are bigoted. The president, in supporting him, would not disagree with this, would he?
Again, I'm not going to speculate on that unless...
While the White House refused to address the issue, a spokesperson for the Department of Health and Human Services defended Dr. Holsinger, saying his 1991 paper, quote, was a summary of scientific peer-reviewed studies at the time. Journalist Max Blumenthal has been following this story. He's a Puffin Foundation writing fellow at the Nation Institute. His work appears in The Nation and Salon and other publications. He's in our Firehouse studio. And on the phone from Phoenix, Arizona, is Jim Burraway. He runs the website boxturtlebulletin.com, which seeks to refute stereotypes and misinformation about gays, lesbians, and bisexuals, has written extensively about Holsinger's 1991 paper. Let's begin with you, Jim. 1991, the paper that Dr. Holsinger wrote.
It's an interesting paper, to say the least, because he writes it for the United Methodist Church, and he's trying to provide scientific evidence to support their what is essentially a theological theory where they talk about the complementarity of male and female couples, opposite sex couples. And he tries to build the case that science or medicine proves that same-sex couples are pathological. He uses the term pathophysiology. In other words, that it's our bodies that tell us that there's something pathological about it. And so he wrote this paper with, if you just read the paper by itself, I could see where you'd be inclined to think, well, you know, gee, there's clearly something going wrong if gay men are suffering from all of these terrible diseases and all of these terrible injuries from having sex with each other. The problem with the paper, though, I've found that in papers like this, this is fascinating. This is true with basically all anti-gay tracts in general. And I believe that this one kind of qualifies more as an anti-gay tract than a scientific paper. The problem is that you really have to go to the bibliography or the footnotes to find out what's really going on. And the fascinating thing about it is that the sources that he used to essentially condemn gay men, the sources that he used are all describing injuries that are found in emergency room settings, and sexually transmitted diseases from one STD clinic in Copenhagen, Denmark. And the emergency room injuries are also sustained by straight people having, I guess you would say, heterosexual sex. And so it's just a strange thing to see how someone can take evidence of what straight people are doing and ending up in emergency rooms for and saying, aha, this proves that gay sex is pathophysiologically bad.
It was reported Reverend J. Philip Wogeman, the main writer for the committee, said the report reflected Dr. Holsinger's view of homosexuality, and that when Dr. Holsinger discerned the committee was preparing a statement that would, quote, recognize the moral dignity of gay and lesbian life if practiced without promiscuity, Wogeman said Dr. Holsinger angrily resigned.
That's pretty amazing. I hadn't heard that, but I mean, I think it does fit with, I hadn't heard those circumstances behind his resignation, but I mean, I think that fits very well with the tone of this paper. I mean, this it's described as a wide-ranging review of the medical literature. Well, it's clearly not. I mean, he had to step around an awful lot of compelling evidence in order to cherry pick the pieces that he pulled out and to put in this paper. I mean, this isn't a dispassioned review of the literature. It's an impassioned condemnation of gay people.
Max Blumenthal, you've been writing about Dr. Holsinger's record. Put it in a bigger context. What is the Bush administration doing with this nomination for Surgeon General?
Well, this nomination's another sop to the Christian right. You know, they're trying to get their base revved up. I subscribe to various Christian right newsletters, and they're just bombarding me with emails and with newsletters saying this is another case of religious bigotry by the Democrats. They're forcing Dr. Holsinger to check his Christianity at the door. So even if his nomination fails, they've gotten the base revved up. They've gotten the Christian right interested again. The Christian right is essentially controls this administration. And so they're doing a lot of damage in the process by nominating someone to a scientific institution who's hostile to science, someone who has shown in his career almost as much hostility to homosexuals as he has to disabled veterans. You know, before Walter Reed made it cool to abuse veterans, Dr. Holsinger was, as the head of the VA, forced to personally admit blame for the 6 deaths at a Chicago hospital he administered, 30 hospitals he administered. Were ruled by a government investigation to have substandard care for veterans. And, you know, I think Dr. Holsinger might argue that, you know, he can hold these views about homosexuals and still be qualified for the Surgeon General, but he can't argue that he doesn't believe in science. And that's just on the record. It's established. If you believe in ex-gay therapy, which he does, if you believe that you can pray away the gay, which he does, you are rejecting 30 years of science. The American Psychiatric Association, the largest association of mental health professionals, has, you know, stopped listing homosexuality as a mental disorder in 1974, and they've contributed to virtually every Surgeon General's annual report. So he's rejecting the mental health community right there. And this reflects a larger trend in the administration of hostility to science. You know, you have the NASA chief, Michael Griffin, who doesn't believe global warming exists. You have the former chair of the President's Council on Bioethics, which rubber-stamped his veto of stem cell science, Leon Cass, who says that women's natural function in life is to have children. And he's spoken out most fervently against what he sees as one of the biggest social evils, the public licking of ice cream cones. Another member of the President's Council of Bioethics, Robert George, who I profiled for The Nation, wants laws enacted to ban masturbation, which would sort of create a vicious cycle once you throw people in prison for that, because there's nothing else to do. Robert Brame, nominated for the National Labor Relations Board, believes that homosexuals, abortion doctors, and disobedient children should be executed according to biblical law. Joe McElhaney, former co-chair of the President's Advisory Council on AIDS, still a member, believes AIDS can be spread by sweat and tears. Current co-chair, Senator Tom Coburn, anti-condom activist, and his chief of staff told me at a right-wing conference I was covering that he thinks liberal federal judges should not only be impeached but impaled as well. So you have in charge of scientific institutions sexual troglodytes who might be qualified to administer tribal regions in Pakistan, but they are just not qualified to be in charge of these institutions. And so I think the nightmare isn't over. You know, we have 1 year left, but the administration continues throwing these sops to the base. And, you know, you saw in your last segment how they fomented a civil crisis in Gaza, or they fomented a culture war at home.
Max, the New York Times was the one that quoted Wogerman saying that when the committee was preparing the statement that would recognize the moral dignity of gay men and lesbians if practiced without promiscuity, Holsinger angrily resigned. They also quoted Maria Kemplin, a lesbian who works as a budget and policy analyst for Dr. Holsinger when he was chancellor, saying he never expressed anything but acceptance and fairness in the workplace. And the Louisville, Kentucky Journal, the Courier Journal, reports more than a dozen Kentuckians who've worked with the former Secretary of the State Cabinet for Health and Family Services and the Chancellor of the University of Kentucky's Chandler Medical Center say he is not bigoted and deeply committed to providing health care for all.
Well, I'm sure he's a very nice man, and that was the argument in favor of Samuel Alito, too. That's their argument all the time, but he's disqualified by his rejection of established medical science, which is required to be Surgeon General. Even C. Everett Koop, who was Reagan's Surgeon General, who is a fervent anti-abortion activist, believed in science, recommended sex education to stop the AIDS crisis that was brewing during the 80s. He was forced out because of the same right-wing activists who have demanded Holsinger's confirmation. You have a really dangerous situation. This is a guy, Holsinger, who's donated $16,000 to George W. Bush. He's extremely compromised. He's a right-wing activist. When he wrote this sickeningly lurid paper for the United Methodist Church, he was engaged in a right-wing, a sophisticated and well-funded right-wing effort to undermine the historically progressive wing of the United Methodist Church. At the time, they were liberalizing their policy towards homosexuals to allow homosexuals to serve openly in the clergy. Dr. Holsinger was the point man for the right to make sure that didn't happen. And his paper was not a scientific review of, homosexual sex. It was actually an effort to smear homosexuals to make way for this right-wing effort.
And that, as a chancellor at the University of Kentucky, he once faced down two conservative state senators who threatened to withhold funding from a lesbian health care seminar at the University of Kentucky in 2002.
He's accused of embezzling $20 million from a foundation which he took over in Kentucky when he was in charge of Kentucky's Health Services Administration. Kentucky sank to the bottom of the country. And some of his peers accused him of driving their healthcare system to third world standards. So, you know, not only is he a failure, but he's a dedicated cultural warrior who's extremely compromised, and he doesn't believe in science.
The last less than 2 years of the Bush administration, what do you see this in the this choice? How does this fit into these 2 years? What kind of effect do you think Bush will have in these final 2 years?
Well, as I said before, the nightmare isn't over. This is, the Bush administration is going to continue to try to maintain the base and the coalition that Karl Rove has created through his strategy establishing a majority of the majority, going for the base. This base is the Republican Party, and they're going to push the Republican Party even further to the right. They control the nominating process. People like James Dobson, people like the characters I spoke about are the ones who are defining the domestic policy of this administration. And on an international level, people like Elliot Abrams are creating conflict abroad. They've substituted.
But do you think Bush's power is diminished at this point?
Bush is essentially irrelevant at this point. And what they're trying to do is hold the Republican coalition together by throwing these various sops to the base. It's not about policy. It's about politics. And that's what Holsinger represents here. Whether he gets confirmed or not, I think the Bush administration has accomplished its aim of holding the Republican coalition in place for Bush's successor.
Last comments. As you not only write about Dr. Holsinger, but write about these individuals who populate the Bush administration right now.
Well, these individuals who are in the Bush administration, it's hard to identify who they are, but, we've seen through the Attorney General scandal, for instance, Monica Goodling, who is one of 150 graduates of Pat Robertson's Regent University in the administration. These people become former White House officials once this is over.
We're going to have to leave it there. Max Blumenthal, thanks for joining us, and thank you to Jim Burraway. That does it for the broadcast tonight. I'll be in Chicago. You can go to our website, Holy Name Cathedral, at 7 p.m. at the Jubilee Conference tomorrow. Also in Chicago, check democracynow.org. I am Amy Goodman. The show is produced by Mike Berkshire, Fabdo Kadush, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Kressar, Matei Janutz, Angelique Kamat, Nicole Salazar, Mike DiFilippo, Nick Marsilio, Miguel Nogueira, our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Jerome Bourgeois, Kieran Krug-Meadows. Thanks for joining us.